Richard pointed at the man sitting on the ground not far away, the man with the notch in his right ear, the man Kalin had touched. Some of the storm within Richard boiled to the surface. There is the man the orders from Nicholas were sent to. He brought with him those men you saw at our last camp. Had we not defended ourselves, had we put our own sincere hatred of violence above the nature of reality, we would be as lost as Merrilee. Owen stared at the man. What is his name? I don't know, and it doesn't matter to me in the least. He fought for the Imperial Order, fought to uphold a view of all life, including his, as unimportant, interchangeable, expendable in the mindless pursuit of an ideal that holds individual lives as worthless in themselves, a tenet that demands sacrifice to others until you are nothing. He fights for the dream of everybody to be nobody and nothing. The beliefs of the Order hold that you had no right to love Merrilee, that everyone is the same, and so your duty should be to marry someone who could best use your help. In that way, through selfless sacrifice, you would properly serve your fellow man. Despite how you struggle not to see what's before your eyes, Owen, I think somewhere beneath all your regurgitated teachings, you know that that is the greatest horror brought by the Order, not their brutality, but their ideas. It is their beliefs that sanction brutality, and yours that invite it. He didn't value his own life, who he was. Why should I care what his name was? I give him what was his greatest ambition, nothingness. When Richard saw Kalin shivering in the cold drizzle, he withdrew his hot glare from Owen and retrieved her cloak from her pack in the wagon. With the utmost gentleness and care, he wrapped it around her shoulders. By the look on his face, he seemed to have had all he could take of listening to Owen. Kalin seized his hand, holding it to her cheek for a moment. There was some small good in the story they had heard from Owen. "This means that the gift isn't killing you, Richard," she said in a confidential tone. "It was the poison." She was relieved that they hadn't run out of time to get him help, as she had so feared on that brief, eternal wagon ride when he'd been unconscious. "I had the headaches before I ran into Owen. I still have the headaches. The sword's magic as well faltered before I was poisoned. But at least this now gives us more time to find the solutions to those problems." He ran his fingers back through his hair. "I'm afraid we have worse problems now, and not the time you think."
"Worse problems?"
Richard nodded. "You know the empire Owen comes from? Bandakar? Guess what Bandakar means?" Kalin glanced at Owen sitting hunched on the crate and all by himself. She shook her head as her gaze returned to Richard's gray eyes, troubled more by the suppressed rage in his voice than anything else.
"I don't know. What?"
"In High Dhaharan, it's a name. It means the banished. Remember from the book The Pillars of Creation when I was telling you what it said about how they decided to send all the pristinely ungifted people away to the old world to banish them? Remember that I said no one ever knew what became of them? We just found out. The world is now naked before the people of the Bandakaran Empire." Kalin frowned.
"How can you know for certain that he is a descendant of those people?
Look at him. He's blonde and looks more like full-blooded Dhaharans than he does the people down here in the old world. More importantly, though, he's not affected by magic."
"But that could be just him."
Richard leaned in closer. "In a closed place like he comes from, a place shut off from the rest of the world for thousands of years, even one pillar of creation would have spread that ungifted trait throughout the entire population by now. But there wasn't just one. They were all ungifted. For that, they were banished to the old world, and in the old world, where they tried to establish a new life, they were again all collected and banished to that place beyond those mountains, a place they were told was for the Bandakar, the banished."
"How did the people of the old world find out about them? How did they keep them all together, without a single one surviving to spread their ungifted trait to the general population? And how did they manage to then put them all in that place, banish them?"
"Good questions all, but right now, not the important ones." "Owen," Richard called as he turned back to the others, "I want you to stay right there, please, while the rest of us decide what will be our single voice about what we must do." Owen brightened at a method of doing things with which he identified and felt comfortable. He didn't seem to detect, as did Kalin, the undercurrent of sarcasm in Richard's voice.
You, Richard said to the man Kalin had touched, go sit beside him and see that he waits there with you. While the man scurried to do as he was told, Richard tilted his head in gesture to the rest of them, calling them away with him. We need to talk. Friedrich, Tom, Jensen, Kara, and Kalin followed Richard away from Owen and the man. Richard leaned back against the chafing rail of the wagon and folded his arms as they all gathered close around him. He took time to appraise each face looking at him. We have big problems, Richard began, and not just from the poison Owen gave me. Owen isn't gifted. He's like you, Jensen. Magic doesn't touch him. His gaze remained locked on Jensen's. The rest of his people are the same as he, as you. Jensen's jaw fell open in astonishment. She looked confused, as if unable to reconcile it all in her mind. Friedrich and Tom looked nearly as startled. Kara's brow drew down in a dark frown.
Richard, Jensen finally said, that just can't be. There's too many of them. There's no way that they can all be half-brothers and sisters of ours.
They aren't half-brothers and sisters, Richard said. They're a line of people descended from the House of Rahl, people like you. I don't have time right now to explain all of it to you, but remember how I told you that you would bear children who were like you, and they would pass that pristinely ungifted trait on to all future generations? Well, back a long time ago, there were people like that spreading in Dahara. The people back then gathered up all these ungifted people and sent them to the old world. The people down here then sealed them away beyond those mountains there. The name of their empire, Bandakar, means the banished. Jensen's big blue eyes filled with tears. She was one of those people. People so hated that they had been banished from the rest of the people in their own land and sent into exile. Kalin put an arm around her shoulders. Remember how you said that you felt alone in the world? Kalin smiled warmly. You don't have to feel alone anymore. There are people like you. Kalin didn't think her words seemed to help much, but Jensen welcomed the comfort of the embrace. Jensen abruptly looked back up at Richard. That can't be true. They had a boundary that kept them locked in that place. If they were like me, they wouldn't be affected by a boundary of magic. They could have come out of there any time they wished. Over all this time, at least some of them would have come out into the rest of the world. The magic of the boundary couldn't have held them back. I don't think that's true, Richard said. Remember when you saw the sand flowing sideways in that warning beacon that Sabar brought us? That was magic, and you saw it. That's right, Kalin said. If she's a pillar of creation, then how is such a thing possible?
That's right, Jensen agreed. How could that be if I'm truly ungifted?
Her eyebrows went up.
Richard, maybe it's not true after all. Maybe I have a bit of the spark of the gift. Maybe I'm not really, truly ungifted.
Richard smiled. Jensen, you're as pure as a snowflake. You saw that magic for a reason. Nikki wrote us in her letter that the warning beacon was linked to the wizard who created it, linked to him in the underworld. The underworld is the world of the dead. That means that statue functioned partly through subtractive magic, magic having to do with the underworld. You may be immune to magic, but you are not immune to death. Gifted or not, you're still linked to life, and thus death. That's why you saw some of the magic of the statue, the part relating to the advancement of death. The boundary was a place in this world where death itself existed. To go into that boundary was to enter the world of the dead. No one returns from the dead. If any pristinely ungifted person in Bandakar had gone into the boundary, they would have died. That was how they were sealed in.
But they could banish people through the boundary, Jensen pressed. That would have to mean that the boundary didn't really affect them.
Richard was shaking his head even as she was protesting. No, they were touched by death the same as anyone. But there was a way left through the boundary, much like the one that once divided the three lands of the New World. I got through that boundary without being touched by it. There was a pass through it, a special, hidden place to get through the boundary. This one was the same.
Jensen wrinkled her nose. That makes no sense, then. If that was true, and it wasn't hidden from them, since they all knew of this passage through the boundary, then why couldn't they all just leave if they wanted to?
How could it seal the rest of them in if they could send banished people through? Richard sighed, wiping a hand across his face. It looked to Kaelin like he wished she hadn't asked that question. "You know the area we passed a while back?" Richard asked her. "That place where nothing grew?" Jensen nodded. "I remember. Well, Sabar said he came through another one, a little to the north of here."
"That's right," Kaelin said, "and it ran toward the center of the wasteland, toward the Pillars of Creation, just like the one we saw. They had to be roughly parallel."
Richard was nodding to what she was beginning to suspect. "And they were to either side of the notch into Bandekar. They weren't very far apart. We're in that place right now, between those two boundaries."
Friedrich leaned in. "But Lord Rahl, that would mean that if someone was banished from the Bandekaran Empire, when they emerged from that boundary, they would find themselves trapped between the walls of these two boundaries out here. And there wasn't much room between them. A person would have nowhere to go, but..."
Friedrich covered his mouth as he turned west, looking off into the gloom.
"The Pillars of Creation,"
Richard finished with quiet finality.
But,
Jensen stammered.
"Are you saying that someone made it that way? Made these two boundaries deliberately to force anyone who was sent out of the Bandekaran Empire to go into that place, the Pillars of Creation? Why?"
Richard looked into her eyes for a long moment. "To kill them."
Jensen swallowed. "You mean, whoever banished these people wanted anyone they in turn sent out, anyone they exiled, to die?"
"Yes," Richard said.
Kaelin pulled her cloak tighter around herself. It had been hot for so long she could hardly believe that the weather had so suddenly turned cold. Richard swiped a lock of wet hair back off his forehead as he went on. "From what Addie told me once, boundaries have to have a pass to create balance on both sides, to equalize the life on both sides. I suspect that those down here in the old world who banished these people wanted to give them a way to get rid of criminals and so told the people about the existence of the pass. But they didn't want such people to be loosed on the rest of the world. Criminals or not, they were ungifted. They couldn't be allowed to run free."
Kaelin immediately saw the problem with his theory.
"But all three boundaries would have had to have a pass," she said. "Even if the other two passes in the remaining two boundaries were secret, that still left the possibility that anyone exiled and sent through the notch might find one of them, and so not try to escape through the Pillars of Creation, where they would die. That left the chance that they might still escape into the old world."
"If there were really three boundaries, such might be the case," Richard said. "But I don't think there were three. I think there really was only one."
"Now you're not making any sense," Kara complained. "You said there was the one going north and south blocking the pass, and then there were these two parallel ones out here, going east and west, to funnel anyone who came out of the Empire through that first boundary, toward the Pillars of Creation where they would die."
Kaelin had to agree. It seemed that there might be a chance for someone to escape through one of the other two.
"I don't think there were three boundaries," Richard repeated. "I think there was only one. That one boundary wasn't straight. It was bent in half." He held two fingers up, side by side. "The bottom of the bend went across the pass."
He pointed at the web between the two fingers. "The two legs extended out here parallel, going off to where they ended at the pillars."
Jensen could only ask, "Why?"
"It seems to me, by how elaborate the whole design was, that the ones who sealed these people in wanted to give them a way to rid themselves of dangerous people, possibly knowing from what they had learned of their beliefs that they would balk at executing anyone. When these people were banished here to the old world, they may have already had at least the core of the same beliefs they hold now. Those beliefs leave them completely vulnerable to those who are evil. Protecting their way of life without executing criminals meant that they had to cast such people out of their community or be destroyed by them. The banishment away from Dahara and the New World, across the barrier into the Old World, must have terrified them. They stuck together as a means of survival, a common bond. Those down here in the Old World who put them behind that boundary must have used those people's fear of persecution to convince them that the boundary was meant to protect them,
to keep others from harming them. They must have convinced those people that since they were special, they needed such protection. That, along with their well-established need to stick together, had to have reinforced in them a terrible fear of being put out of their protected place. Banishment had a special terror to those people. They must have felt the anguish of being rejected by the rest of the peoples of the world because they were ungifted, but together, as they were, they also felt safe behind the boundary. Now that the seal is off, we have big problems. Jensen folded her arms.
Now that there is more than one of us, more than one snowflake, you're having worries about a snowstorm?
Richard fixed her with a reproachful look. Why do you think the order came in and took some of their people?
Apparently, Jensen said, to breed more children like them, to breed precious magic out of the race of man.
Richard ignored the heat in her words. No, I mean, why would they take men?
Same reason, Jensen said, to mate with regular women and give them ungifted children.
Richard drew in a patient breath and let it out slowly.
What did Owen say?
The men were taken to see the women and told that if they didn't follow orders, those women would be skinned alive.
Jensen hesitated. What orders?
Richard leaned toward her. What orders indeed? Think about it, he said, looking around at the rest of them. What orders? What would they want ungifted men for? What is it they would want ungifted men to do?
Kaelin gasped. The keep!
Exactly. Richard's unsettling gaze met each of them in turn. Like I said, we have big problems. Zed is protecting the keep. With his ability and the magic of that place, he can no doubt single-handedly hold off Jagang's entire army. But how is that skinny old man going to resist even one young ungifted man who is untouched by magic and comes up and grabs him by the throat? Jensen's hand came away from her mouth.
You're right, Richard. Jagang, too, has that book, The Pillars of Creation. He knows how those like me aren't touched by magic. He tried to use me in that very way. That's why he worked so hard to convince me that you were trying to kill me, so that I would think my only chance was to kill you first. He knew I was ungifted and couldn't be stopped by magic.
And Jagang is from the old world, Richard added. In all likelihood, he would have known something about the Empire beyond that boundary. For all we know, in the old world, Bandekar might be legendary, while those in the new world, beyond the Great Barrier for 3,000 years, would never have known what happened to those people. Now, the Order has been taking men from there and threatening them with the brutal murder of their defenseless women, women who are loved ones, if those men don't follow orders. I think those orders are to assault the Wizard's Keep and capture it for the Imperial Order.
Kaelin's legs shook. If the keep fell, they would lose the one real advantage, however limited, they had.
With the keep in the hands of the Order, all those ancient and deadly things of magic would be available to Jagang. There was no telling what he might unleash. There were things in the keep that could kill them all, Jagang included. He had already proven with the plague he'd unleashed that he was willing to kill any number to have his way, that he was willing to use any weapon, even if such weapons decimated his own people as well. Even if Jagang did nothing with the keep, just him having control of it denied the Daharan Empire the possibility of finding something there that could help them. That was, in addition to protecting the keep, what Zed was doing while he was there, trying to find something that would help them win the war, or at least find a way to put the Imperial Order back behind a barrier of some kind and confine them to the old world. Without the keep, their cause would likely be hopeless. Resistance would be nothing more than delaying the inevitable. Without the keep on their side, all resistance to Jagang would eventually be crushed. His troops would pour into every part of the new world. There would be no stopping them. With trembling fingers, Kaelin clutched her cloak closed. She knew what awaited her people, what it was like when the Imperial Order invaded and overpowered places. She had been with the army for nearly a year fighting against them. They were like a pack of wild dogs. There was no peace with such animals after you. They would be satisfied only when they could tear you apart. Kaelin had been to cities like Ebenezia that had been overrun by Imperial Order soldiers. In a wild binge of savagery that went on for days, they had tortured, raped, and murdered every person trapped in the city, finally leaving it a wasteland of human corpses. None, no matter their age, had been spared. That was what the people of the New World had to look forward to. With enemy troops overrunning all of the New World, any trade that was not already disrupted would be brought to a standstill. Nearly all businesses would fail. The livelihood of countless people would be lost. Food would quickly become scarce and then simply unavailable at any cost. People would have no means of supporting themselves and their families. People would lose everything for which they had worked a lifetime. Cities, even before the troops arrived, would be in a destructive panic. When the enemy troops arrived, most people would be burned out of their homes, driven from their cities and their land. Jigang would steal all supplies of food for his troops and give conquered land to his favored elite. The true owners of that land would perish or become slaves working their own farms. Those who escaped before the invading horde would desperately cling to life, living like animals in wild areas. Most of the population would be in flight, running for their lives. Hundreds of thousands would be out in the elements without shelter. There would be little food and no ability to prepare for winter. When the weather turned harsh, they would perish in droves. As civilization crumbled and starvation became the norm, disease would sweep across the land, catching up those on the run. Families would collapse as those they depended on suffered agonizingly slow and painful deaths. Children and the weak would be alone, to be preyed upon as a source of food for the starving. Kayla knew what such widespread disease was like. She knew what it was like to watch people dying by the thousands. She had seen it happen in Adendrill when the plague was there. She saw scores stricken without warning. She had watched the old, the young, such good people, contract something they could not fight. Watched them suffer in misery for days before they died. Richard had been stricken with that plague. Unlike everyone else, though, he had gotten it knowingly. Taking the plague deliberately had been the price to get back to her. He had traded his life just to be with her again before he died. That had been a time beyond horror. Kayla knew firsthand savage desperation. It was then that she had taken the only chance available to her to save his life. It was then that she had loosed the chimes. That act had saved Richard's life. She hadn't known at the time that it would also be a catalyst that would set unforeseen events into motion. Because of her desperate act, the boundary to this empire had lost its power and failed. Because of her, all magic might eventually fail. Now, because of that boundary failing, the Wizard's Keep, their last bastion to work a solution against the Order, was in terrible jeopardy. Kaelin felt as if it were all her fault. The world was on the brink of destruction. Civilization stood at the threshold of obliteration in the name of the Order's mindless idea of a greater good. The Order demanded sacrifice to that greater good. What they were determined to sacrifice was reason, and therefore civilization itself. Madness had cast its shadow across the world and would have them all. They now stood in the edge of the shadow of a dark age. They were all on the eve of the end times. Kaelin couldn't say that, though. She couldn't tell them how she felt. She dared not reveal her despair. "Richard, we simply can't allow the Order to capture the keep." Kaelin could hardly believe how calm and determined her voice sounded. She wondered if anyone else would believe that she thought they still stood a chance. "We have to stop them." "I agree," Richard said. He sounded determined, too. She wondered if he saw in her eyes the true depths of her despair. "First," he said, "the easy part, Nikki and Victor. We have to tell them that we can't come now. Victor needs to know what we would say to him. He will need to know that we agree with his plans, that he must proceed, and that he can't wait for us. We've talked with him. He knows what to do. Now he must do it, and Priska must know that he has to help. Nikki needs to know where we're going. She needs to know that we believe we've discovered the cause of the warning beacon. She has to know where we are." He left unsaid that she had come to help him if he couldn't get to her because the gift was killing him. "She needs to know, too," Richard said.
that we only had a chance to read part of her warning about what Jigang was doing with the Sisters of the Dark in creating weapons out of people. Everyone's eyes widened. They hadn't read the letter.
Well, Kalin said, with all the other problems we have, at least that's one we won't have to deal with for now.
We have that much on our side, Richard agreed. He gestured to the man, watching the man, waiting for Kalin to command him.
We'll send him to Victor and Nikki, so they will know everything.
And then what? Kara asked. I want Kalin to command him that when he's finished with carrying out that part of his orders, he's then to go north and find the Imperial Order Army. I want him to pretend to be one of them to get close enough to assassinate Emperor Jigang.
Kalin knew how implausible such a scheme was. By the way everyone stared in astonishment, they had a good idea, too.
Jigang has layers of men to protect him from assassination, Jensen said. He's always surrounded by special guards. Regular soldiers can't even get close to him.
Do you really think he has any chance at all to accomplish such a thing? Kalin asked.
No, Richard admitted. The order will most likely kill him before he can get to Jigang. But he will be driven by the need to fulfill your orders. He will be single-minded. I expect he will be killed in the effort, but I also suspect he will at least make a good attempt of it. I want Jigang to at least lose some sleep, knowing that any of his men might be assassins. I want him to worry that he will never know who might be trying to kill him. I don't want him ever to be able to sleep soundly. I want him to be haunted by nightmares of what might be coming next, of who among his men might be waiting for an opening.
Kalin nodded her agreement. Richard appraised the grim faces, waiting for the rest of what he had to say.
Now to the most important part of what must be done. It's vital we get to the keep and warn Zed. We can't delay. Jigang is ahead of us in all this. He's been planning and acting, and we never realized what he was up to. We don't know how soon these ungifted men might be sent north. We haven't a moment to lose.
Lord Rall, Kara reminded him. You have to get to the antidote before time runs out. You can't go running off to the keep to...
Oh, no.
Now, you just wait a minute. You're not sending me to the keep again. I'm not leaving you at a time like this, at a time when you're next to defenseless. I won't hear of it, and I won't go.
Richard laid a hand on her shoulder. Kara, I'm not sending you, but thanks for offering.
Kara folded her arms and shot him a fiery scowl. We can't take the wagon up into Bandakar. There's no road.
Lord Rall, Tom interrupted, without magic, you'll need all the steel you have.
He sounded only slightly less emphatic than Kara had.
Richard smiled. I know, Tom, and I agree. It's Friedrich who I think must go.
Richard turned to Friedrich. You can take the wagon. An older man by himself will raise less suspicion than would any of the rest of us. They won't see you as a threat. You will be able to make better time with the wagon, and without having to worry that the order might snatch you and put you in the army. Will you do it, Friedrich?
Friedrich scratched his stubble. A smile came to his weathered face.
I guess I'm at last being called upon to be a boundary warden of sorts.
Richard smiled with him. Friedrich, the boundary has failed. As the Lord Rall, I appoint you to the post of boundary warden, and ask that you immediately undertake to warn others of the danger come from out of that boundary.
Friedrich's smile departed as he put a fist to his heart in salute and solemn pledge. Chapter 26 Somewhere back in a distant room where his body waited, Nicholas heard an insistent noise. He was absorbed in the task at hand, so he ignored the sound. The light was fading, and although light helped to see, darkness would not hinder eyes such as he used. Again he heard the noise, indignant that the sound kept calling him, kept annoying him, kept demanding his attention. He returned to his body. Someone was banging a fist on the door. Nicholas rose from the floor, where his body sat cross-legged, taking his body with him. It was always, at first, disorienting to have to be in his body again, to be so limited, so confined. It felt awkward to have to move it about, to use his own muscles, to breathe, to see, to hear with his own senses. The knock came again. Irate at the interruption, Nicholas went not to the door, but to the windows and threw the shutters closed. He cast a hand out, igniting the torch, and finally stalked to the door. Layered strips of cloth covering his robes flowed out behind like a heavy mantle of black feathers.
"What is it?"
He threw open the heavy door and peered out. Najari stood just outside in the hall, his weight on one foot, his thumbs hooked behind his belt. His muscular shoulders nearly touched the walls to each side. Nicholas saw then the huddled crowd behind the man. Najari's crooked nose, flattened to the left in some of the numerous brawls his temper got him into, cast an oddly shaped shadow across his cheek. Anyone unfortunate enough to find themselves in a brawl with Najari usually suffered far worse than a mere broken nose. Najari waggled a thumb over his shoulder.
"You asked for some guests, Nicholas."
Nicholas raked his nails back through his hair, feeling the silken smooth pleasure of oils gliding against his palm. He rolled his shoulders, ruffling away his peak. Nicholas had been so absorbed in what he had been doing that he had forgotten that he had requested that Najari bring him some bodies.
"Very good, Najari. Bring them in, then. Let's have a look at them."
Nicholas watched as the commander led the gaggle of people into the flickering torchlight. Soldiers in the rear herded the stragglers through the door and into the large room. Heads swiveled around, looking at the strange, stark surroundings, at the wooden walls, the torches in brackets, the plank flooring, the lack of furniture other than a stout table. Noses twitched at the sharp smell of blood. Nicholas watched carefully as people spotted the sharpened stakes, standing in a line along the wall to their right, stakes as thick as Najari's wrists. Nicholas studied the people, watching for the telltales of fear as they spread out along the wall beside the door. Eyes flitted about, worried, and at the same time eager to take it all in, so they could report to their friends what they had seen inside. Nicholas knew that he was an object of great curiosity, a rare being, a slide. No one knew what his name meant. This day, some would learn. Nicholas glided past the undulating mob. They were a curious people, these odd, ungifted creatures, curious like mockingbirds, but not nearly so bold. Because they were without any spark whatsoever of the gift, Nicholas had to handle them in special ways in order for them to be of any use to him. It was a bother, but it had its rewards. Some necks craned in his wake, trying to better see the rare man. He ran his nails through his hair again just to feel the oils slide against his hand. As he leaned close to some of the people he passed observing individuals in the gathering, one of the women before him closed her eyes, turning her face away. Nicholas lifted a hand toward her, flicking out a finger. He glanced to Najari to be sure that he saw which one had been picked. Najari's gaze flicked from the woman up to Nicholas. He had noted the selection. A man back against the wall stood stiff, his eyes wide. Nicholas flicked a finger at him. Another man twisted his lips in an odd manner. Nicholas glanced down and saw that the man, in a state of wild fright, had wet himself. Nicholas's finger flitted out again. Three selected. Nicholas walked on. A thin whine escaped the throat of a woman in the front, right before him. He smiled at her. She peered up, trembling, unable to take her wide-eyed gaze from him, from his red-rimmed black eyes, unable to halt the puling sound escaping her throat. She had never seen one so human, yet not. Nicholas tapped her shoulder with a long-nailed finger. He would reward her unspoken revulsion with service to a greater good. His. Jigang had sought to create something unusual for himself. A bauble of flesh and blood, a magical trinket crafted from a wizard, a lapdog with teeth. His Excellency had gotten what he wanted and more, oh, so much more. Nicholas would enjoy seeing how the Emperor liked having a puppet without strings, a specially crafted creation with a mind of its own and talents to fulfill his wishes. A man at the rear against the wall appeared to be somewhat uninterested, as if impatient for the exhibition to be over so he could go back to his own affairs. While none of these people could be said to think of themselves as important individuals with consequential sway over any meaningful aspects of life in their empire, a few occasionally exhibited tendencies, even if inconsistent, towards self-interest. Nicholas flicked his finger for the fifth time. The man would soon have reason to be highly interested in the proceedings, and he would find that he was no better than anyone else. He would be going nowhere, at least not in body. Everyone stared in silence as Nicholas chuckled alone at his own joke. His amusement ended. Nicholas tipped his head toward the door in a single nod. The soldiers jumped into action.
"All right," Najari growled. "Move along, move! Get going! Out, out, out!"
The feet of the crowd shuffled urgently through the door as ordered. Some people cast worried glances back over their shoulders at the five Najari had cut out of the flock. Those five were shoved back when they sought to stay with the rest. A stiff finger to the chest backed them up as effectively as would a club or a sword.
"Don't cause any trouble," Najari warned, "or you will be making trouble for the others."
The five remaining huddled close to one another, rocking nervously side to side like a covey of quail before a bird dog. When the soldiers had driven the rest of the people out, Najari closed the door and stood before it, hands clasped behind his back. Nicholas returned to the windows, opening the shutters on the west wall. The sun was down, leaving a red slash across the sky. Soon, they would be on the wing, on the hunt. Nicholas would be with them. Casting an arm back without needing to turn to look, he doused the torch. The flickering light was a distraction during this cusp of time, the transient twilight that was so fragile, so brief. He would need the light, but at the moment, he wanted only to see the sky, to see the glorious, unbounded sky.
"Are we going to be able to leave soon?"
one of the people asked in a timid squeak. Nicholas turned and peered at them. Najari's eyes revealed which one had spoken. Nicholas followed his commander's gaze. It was one of the men, the one who had been impatient to leave, of course.
"Go?"
Nicholas asked as he swept in close to the man.
"You wish to go?"
The man stood with his back bent, leaning away from Nicholas.
"Well, sir, I was only wondering when we would be going."
Nicholas stooped in even more, peering deeply into the man's eyes.
"Wonder in silence," he hissed.
Returning to the windows, Nicholas rested his hands on the sill, his weight on his arms, as he breathed in deeply the gathering night while taking in the sweep of crimson sky. Soon he would be there, be free. Soon he would soar as no one else but he could. Impulsively, he sought them. Eyes bulging with the effort, he cast his senses where none but his could go.
"There!"
he screeched, throwing his arm out, pointing a long black nail at what none but he could see.
"There! One has taken to wing!"
Nicholas spun around, strips of cloth lifting, floating up. Panting through a rush of fluttering excitement, he gazed at the eyes staring at him. They could not know. They could not understand one such as he, understand what he felt, what he needed. He hungered to be on the hunt, to be with them. Ever since he had imagined such a use for his ability, he had reveled in the experience, dedicating himself to it as he learned his new abilities. He had been off with those glorious creatures as often as he could afford the time ever since he had come here and discovered them. How ironic it now seemed that he had resisted. How odd that he once had feared what those gruesome women, those sisters of the dark, had conspired to do to him, what they had done to him. His duty, they had called it. Their vile magic had cut like a red-hot blade through him. He had thought his eyes might burst from his head from the pain that had seared through him. Tied, spread-eagled, to stakes in the ground in the center of their wicked circle, he had dreaded what they were going to do to him. He had feared it. Nicholas smiled. Hated it, even. He had been afraid because of the pain of what they were doing to him, and the even greater pain of not knowing what more they intended to do to him. His duty, they had called it, to a greater good. His ability bore responsibilities, they had insisted. He watched through glazed eyes as Najari bound the hands of the five people behind each of their backs.
"Thank you, Najari,"
he said when the man had finished. Najari approached.
"The men will have them by now, Nicholas. I told them to send enough men to ensure that they would not escape."
Najari grinned at the prospect.
"There's no need to worry. They should all be on their way back to us."
Nicholas narrowed his eyes.
"We will see. We will see."
He wanted to see it himself, with his own vision, even if his own vision was through another's eyes. Najari yawned on his way to the door.
"See you tomorrow, then, Nicholas."
Nicholas opened his mouth wide, mimicking the yawn. Even though he didn't yawn, it felt good to stretch his jaws wide. Sometimes he felt trapped inside himself and he wanted out. Nicholas closed the door behind Najari and bolted it. It was a perfunctory act, done more to add to the aura of peril than out of necessity. Even with their hands tied behind their backs, these people could together probably overpower him, knock him down and kick in his head if nothing else. But for that, they would have to think, to decide what they ought to do and why, to commit to act. Easier not to think. Easier not to act. Easier to do as you are told. Easier to die than to live. Living took effort, struggle, pain. Nicholas hated it.
"Hate to live, live to hate," he said to the silent, ghostly white faces watching him.
Out the window, the streaks of clouds had gone dark gray as the touch of the sun passed beyond them and night crept in to embrace them. Soon, he would be among them. He turned back from the window, taking in the faces watching him. Soon, they would all be out there among them. Chapter 27. Nicholas seized one of the nameless men. Powered by muscles crafted of the sister's dark art, he hoisted the man into the air. The man cried out in surprise at being lifted so easily. He struggled hesitantly against muscle he would not be able to resist, were he even to put daring into it. These people were immune to magic, or Nicholas would have used his power to easily lift them aloft. Absent the necessary spark of the gift, they had to be manhandled. It made little difference to Nicholas. How they got to the stakes was unimportant. What happened to them once there was all that mattered. As the man in his arms cried out in terror, Nicholas carried him across the room. The other people withdrew into a far corner. They always went to the far corner, like chickens about to be dinner. Nicholas, his arms around the man's chest, lifted him high in the air, judging the distance and angle as he raced ahead. The man's eyes went wide. His mouth did likewise. He gasped with the shock, then grunted, as Nicholas, hugging the man tight in his arms, drove him down onto the stake. The man's breath came in short, sharp gasps as the sharpened stake penetrated up through his insides. He went still in Nicholas's powerful arms, fearing to move, fearing to believe what was happening to him, fearing to know it was true, trying to deny to himself that it could be true. Nicholas straightened to his full height before the man. The man's back was as straight and stiff as a board as he sat impaled on the sharpened stake. His eyebrows pushed his sweat-beaded brow up in furrows as he writhed in slow agony, his legs trying to touch the ground that was too far away. Into that confusion of sensation, Nicholas reached out with his mind, at the same time clawing his hands before the man with the effort, as he slid his own being, his own spirit, into the core of this living creature, slid into this man's open mind, into the cavernous cracks between his abrupt and disconnected thoughts, there to feel his agony and fright, there to take control. Once he had slipped his own mind in there with this man, seeped through his consciousness, Nicholas drew his essence out and into himself. With a staggering fusion of destructive and creative power dealt by those women that day, Nicholas had been born into a new being, part him, and yet more. He had become what no man had ever been before, what others wished to make of him, what others wished him to be. What had been unleashed in him by those sisters, all linked in their ability to harness powers they could never have touched alone and should never have invoked together, they instilled in him. They engendered in him powers few could ever have imagined, the power to slide into another living person's thoughts and withdraw their spirit. He drew his closed fists back toward his own abdomen with the effort of drawing with him the spirit of this man on the cusp of life and death, drew onward the marrow of this man's soul. Nicholas felt the slick heat of this other spirit slide into his, the hot rush of sensation at feeling himself filled with another spirit. Nicholas left the body there, impaled on the first stake, as he rushed to the windows, his head spinning with the first intoxicating wave of excitement at the journey only now just begun, at what was to come, at what power he would control. He opened his mouth wide again in a yawn that was not a yawn, but a call carrying more than just his silent voice. His eyes swam with wavering images. He gasped in the first scent of the forests out beyond, where his intent had been cast. He rushed back and seized a woman. She begged as she wept, begged to be spared as he bore her to her stake.
"But this is nothing," he told her. "Nothing compared to what I have endured. Oh, you cannot imagine what I have endured."
He had been staked naked to the ground, in the center of a circle of those smug women. He had been nothing to them. He had not been a man, a wizard. He had been nothing but the raw material, the flesh and blood innervated by the gift that they needed for what they wanted, that they used in yet another of their trials, all to be twisted by their tinkering at creation. He had the ability, so duty required he sacrifice it. Nicholas had been the first to live through their tests, not because they took care, not because they cared, but because they had learned what didn't work, and so avoided their past errors.
"Scream, my dear, scream all you want. It will help you no more than it helped me."
"Why?" she screamed. "Why?"
"Oh, but I must. If I am to have your spirit to soar on the wings of my distant friends, you will go on a glorious journey, you and I."
"Please," she wailed. "Dear Creator, no."
"Oh, yes, dear Creator," he mocked. "Come and save her like you came and saved me."
Her wailing did her no good. His hadn't either. She had no idea how immeasurably worse his agony had been than hers would be. Unlike her, he had been condemned to live.
"Hate to live, live to hate," he murmured in a comforting whisper. "You will have the glory and the reward that is death."
He drove her down onto the stake. He reckoned her not far enough onto the stake, and shoved her down another 6 inches until he judged it deep enough within her, deep enough to produce the necessary pain and terror, but not deep enough to lance anything inside that would kill her right off. She thrashed, trying desperately, hands helpless behind her back, to somehow remove herself. He was only dimly aware of her cries, her worthless words. She thought they might somehow make a difference. Pain was his goal. Their complaints of it only confirmed that he was achieving his goal. Nicholas stood before the woman, hands clawed, as he slid his own spirit through her sundered thoughts and into the core of her being. With mental strength far superior to his physical strength, he pulled her back. He gasped as he felt her spirit slide into his. For now, he slipped those spirits out of tortured, dying bodies. While those spirits existed in the netherworld between the worldly form they knew was lost to them, but still alive, and the world of the dead already calling them in from beyond. Life could no longer hold them, but death could not yet have them. In that time of spiritual transition, they were his, and he could use those spirits for things only he could imagine. And he had not yet really even begun to imagine. Such ability as he possessed was not something that could be taught by another. There was no other but he. He was still learning the extent of his powers, the things he could do with the spirit of another. He had only scratched the surface. Emperor Jagang had sought to create something akin to himself, a dreamwalker, a brother of sorts, one who could enter another's mind. He had gotten far more than he could ever have imagined. Nicholas didn't simply slide into another's thoughts as Jagang did. He could slide into their very soul and draw their spirit back into himself. The sisters hadn't counted on that aberration of their tinkering with his ability. Rushing to the window, his mouth pulled open as wide as it would go into a yawn that wasn't a yawn. The room swam behind him. It was only partly there now. Now he was beginning to see other places, glorious places. See them with new vision, with spirits no longer bound to their paltry bodies. He rushed to the third person, no longer aware even if they were man or woman. Their soul was all that mattered, their spirit. He drove them onto a stake with urgent effort, slid into them and drew their spirit into his, shuddering with the power of it entering him. He rushed to the window again, opening wide his mouth again, twisting his head side to side with the thrill of it, the slick, silken, sliding ecstasy of it, the loss of physical orientation, the exaltation of being above his corporeal existence. The former bounds of his mere worldly form, carried aloft not simply with his own efforts, but by the spirits of others that he had freed from their bodies. What a glorious thing it was! It was almost like the joy he imagined death would be. He seized the fourth weeping person and, with delirious expectation, ran with them across the room to the stakes, to the fourth stake, and drove them screaming onto it. As he lurched back from them, he thrust himself into their wildly racing, confused, swirling thoughts and took what was there for the taking. He took their spirit into himself. When he controlled a person's spirit, he controlled their very existence. He became life and death for them. He was their savior, their destroyer. He was in many ways like those spirits he took, trapped in a worldly form, hating to live, to endure the pain and agony that was life, yet fearing to die, even while longing for the promise of its sweet embrace. With four spirits swirling through him, Nicholas staggered to the fifth person, cowering in the corner. "Please!" the man wailed, hands held up to ward what he would not commit to warding. "Please don't!" The thought occurred to Nicholas that the stakes were really a hindrance. Using them required him to carry people around like woolly sheep to have their souls sheared. Yes, he was still learning what he could do and how to control what he did, but to have to use the stakes was limiting. When he thought about it, it was actually insulting that a wizard of his ability would have to use so crude a device. What he really wanted to do was to slide into another's spirit and take it without any warning, without needing to bring people to the stakes. When he was fully able to do that, to simply walk up to another, say, "Good day," and slide, like the thrust of a dagger, into the heart of their spirit, there to draw it into his, then he would be invincible. When he was able to do that, then no one could challenge him. No one would be able to deny him anything. As the man shrank down before him, Nicholas, before he fully realized what it was he was doing, driven by an angry need, by hatred, thrust out his hand as he thrust his own mind into this man, into the spaces between thought. The man stiffened, just as those on the stakes stiffened when Nicholas had impaled them with his ability. He drew back his closed fist toward his middle as he drew in this man's spirit. He gasped with the heat of it, with the silky, slick feel of it sliding into him. They stared at each other, each in shock, each considering what this meant for them. The man slumped back against the wall, sliding down in soundless, silent, terrible, empty agony. Nicholas realized that he had just done what he had never done before. He had just taken a soul by his will alone. He had just freed himself to take what he wanted, when he wanted, where he wanted. Chapter 28. Nicholas, his vision a blur, staggered to the window. All five were his now. This time, as his mouth opened wide, a cry at last came forth, a cry of the five spirits joining his as he drew them together into one force, guided by his will alone. Their worldly agony was a distant concern to them. Five spirits gazed out of the windows along with him. Five spirits now waiting to soar out into the night to where he chose to send them. Those sisters had not known what they unleashed that night. They could not have known the power they fused into him, the ability they burned into him. They had achieved what none had achieved for thousands of years, the altering of a wizard into something more, honing him into a weapon of specific intent. They had imbued him with power beyond that of anyone living. They had given him dominion over the spirits of others. Most had escaped, but he had killed five of them. The five were enough. After he had slid into their souls and pulled their spirits back into his that night, he had appropriated their Han, their force of life, their power, for himself. It was only fitting, as their Han was not natural to them, but was male Han they had stolen from young wizards, a birthright they had sucked from those to whom it belonged in order to give themselves abilities they had not been born with, could not be born with. Yet more nameless people with ability to be sacrificed to those who needed it or simply wanted it. Nicholas had taken it all back from their trembling bodies, pulled it out of them, as he had clawed their living insides open. They had been sorry that they had done Jagang's bidding, that they had twisted him into something creation never intended. Not only had they made him into a slide, they had given up their Han to him and made him that much more powerful for it. After each of those five women had died, the world had gone darker than dark for an instant when the Keeper had come and taken them to his realm. The sisters had destroyed him that day, and they had created him. He had a lifetime to explore and discover what he could do with his new abilities. And to be sure, Jagang would grant him payment for that night. Jagang would pay. But he would pay gladly, for Nicholas would give him something none but Nicholas the Slide could give him. Nicholas would be rewarded with things enough to repay him for what had been done to him. He hadn't decided yet what that reward would be, but it would be worthy of him. He would use his ability to hold sway over lives, important lives. He no longer needed to cart people to the stakes. He knew how to take what he wanted now. Now he knew how to slip into their minds at the time of his choosing and take their souls. He would trade those lives for what he would have in power, wealth, splendor. It would have to be something appropriate. He would be an emperor. It would have to be more than this petty empire of sheep, though. He would frolic in rule. He would have his every whim fulfilled once he was given dominion over something important. He hadn't decided just what yet. It was an important decision, what he would have as his reward. No need to rush it. It would come to him. He turned from the window, the five spirits swirling within his, soaring through him. It was time to use what he had pulled together. Time to get down to business. If he was to have what he wanted, he would get closer this time. He was frustrated from not being closer, from not seeing better. It was dark now. He would get closer this time, under cover of the darkness. Nicholas took the broad bowl from the table and placed it on the floor before the five who still owned the spirits within him. They writhed in otherworldly agony, even the man not on the stake, an agony of both body and soul. Nicholas sat cross-legged on the floor before the bowl. Hands on his knees, he threw his head back, eyes closed, as he gathered the power within, the power created by those wicked women, those wonderful wicked women. They had considered him a pathetic wizard of little worth except as flesh and blood, and gift to toy with, a sacrifice to a greater need. When he had time, he would go after the rest of them. With a more immediate task at hand, Nicholas dismissed those sisters from his mind. Tonight he would not merely watch through other eyes. Tonight he would again go with the spirits he cast. Tonight he would not merely watch through other eyes. Tonight his spirit would travel to them. Nicholas opened his mouth as wide as it would go, his head rocking from side to side. The joined spirits within released a part of themselves into the bowl, whirling in a silken, silvery swirl lit with the soft glow of their link to the life behind him. Placekeepers for their journey, a stitch in the world holding the knot in the thread of their travels. His spirit, too, let slip a small portion to remain with his body, to drift in the bowl with the others. Fragments of the five spirits revolved with the fragment of his, their light of life glowing softly in this safe place as he prepared to journey. He cast his own spirit away then, leaving behind the husk of a body sitting on the floor behind him as he fled out into the dark sky, borne on the wings of his invested power. No wizard before had ever been able to do as he, to leave his body and have his spirit soar to where his mind would send him. He raced through the night fast as thought to find what he hunted. He felt the rush of air flowing over feathers. As quick as that, he had raced away through the night and was with them, pulling the five spirits along with him. He summoned the dark forms into a circle with him, and as they gathered around, cast the five spirits into them. His mouth was still open in a yawn that was not a yawn, that back in a room somewhere distant let forth a cry to match the five. As they circled, he felt the rush of air beneath their wings, felt their feathers working the wind to direct them as effortlessly as his own thought directed not only his spirit, but the other five as well. He sent those five racing through the night to the place where he had sent the men. They raced over hills, turning to scan the open country, to look out over the barren land. The cloak of darkness felt cool, encasing him in obscure black night, obscure black feathers. He caught the scent of carrion, sharp, cloying, tantalizing, as the five spiraled down toward the ground. Through their eyes that saw in the darkness, Nicholas saw then the scene below, a place littered with the dead. Others of their kind had gathered to feed in a frenzy of ripping and gorging. No, this was wrong. He didn't see them. He had to find them. He willed his charges up from the gory feast to search. Nicholas felt a pang of urgency. This was his future that had slipped away from him, his treasure slipping through his grasp. He had to find them, had to. He spurred his charges onward. This way, that way, over there. Look, 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 find them, look. Must find them, look. This was not supposed to be. There had been enough men. No one could escape that many experienced men, not when they came by stealth and attacked with surprise. They had been selected for their talents. They knew their business. Their bodies lay sprawled all about, beak and claw ripped at them, screeches of excitement, hunger. No, must find them. Up, 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 find them. He had to find them. He had suffered the agony of a new birth in those dark woods, those terrible woods with those terrible women. He would have his reward. He would not be denied. Not now, not after all that. Find them. Look, 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 find them. On powerful wings he soared into the night. With eyes that saw in the dark he searched. With creatures that could catch the scent of prey at great distance, he tried for a whiff of them. Through the night they went, hunting, hunting. There he saw their wagon. He recognized their wagon, their big horses. He had seen it before, seen them with it before. His minions circled in close on nearly silent wings, dropping in closer to see what Nicholas sought. Not there. They weren't there. A trick. It had to be a trick. A diversion. Not there. They had sent the wagon away to trick him, to send him off their trail. With wings powered by anger, he soared up, up, up to search the countryside. Hunt! Hunt! Find them! He flew with his five in an ever wider pattern to search the ground beneath the night. They flew on, searching, searching. His hunger was their hunger. Hunt for them! Hunt! The wings grew weary as he drove them onward. He had to find them. He would not allow rest, not allow failure. He hunted in expanding swathes, searching, hunting, hunting. There, among the trees, he saw movement. It was only just dark. They wouldn't see their pursuers, not in the dark. But he could see them. He forced the five down, circling, circling. Forced them in close. He would not fail this time to see them, to get close enough. Circling, holding him there. Circling, watching, seeing them there. It was her, the mother confessor. He saw others, the one with red hair and her small four-legged friend. Others too. He must be there too, had to be there too. He would be there, too, as the small group moved west. West. They moved west. They had traveled to the west of where he had seen them last. Nicholas laughed. They were coming west. The captors sent for them all lay dead. But here they came anyway. They were coming west, toward where he waited. He would have them. He would have Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor. Jagang would have them. It came to him then, his reward, what he would have in return for the prizes he would deliver. Dahara. He would have the rule of Dahara in return for these two paltry people. Jagang would reward him with the rule of Dahara, if he wanted those two. He would not dare deny Nicholas the Slide what he wanted, not when he had what Jagang wanted most. More than any other prize, Jagang would pay any price for these two. Pain, a scream, shock, terror, confusion raged through him. He felt the wind that carried him so effortlessly, now ripping at him like fists, snatching at feathers as he tumbled in helpless pain. One of the five falling at blinding speed smacked the ground. Nicholas screamed. One of the five spirits had been lost with its host. Back somewhere distant, in some far-off room with wooden walls and shutters and bloody stakes. Back, back, back in another place he had almost forgotten existed. Back, 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 far away, a spirit was ripped from his control. One of the five back there had died at the same instant the race had crashed to the ground. Scream of hot pain. Another tumbled out of control. Another spirit escaped his grasp into the waiting arms of death. Nicholas struggled to see in the confusion, forcing the remaining three to hold his vision in place so he could see. Hunt! 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 Where was he? Where was he? Where? He saw the others. Where was Lord Rawl? A third scream. Where was he? Nicholas fought to hold his vision despite the hot agony, the bewildering plummet. Pain ripped through a fourth. Before he could gather his senses, hold them together, force them with the power of his will to do his bidding, two more spirits were yanked away into the void of the underworld. Where was he? Talons at the ready, Nicholas searched. There! There! With violent effort, he forced the race over into a dive. There he was! There he was! Up high, higher than the rest. Somehow, up high. Up on a ledge of rock above the rest, He wasn't down there with them. He was up high. Dive for him. Dive down for him. There he was. Bow drawn. Ripping pain tore through the last race. The ground rushed up at him. Nicholas cried out. He tried frantically to stop the spinning. He felt the race slam into the rock at frightening speed, but only for an instant. With a gasp, Nicholas drew a desperate breath. His head spun with the burning torture of the abrupt return, an uncontrolled return not of his doing. He blinked, his mouth open wide in an attempt to let out a cry, but no sound came. His eyes bulged with the effort, but no cry came. He was back. Whether or not he wanted to be, he was back. He looked around at the room. He was back. That was the reason no cry came. No screech of a race joined his own. They were dead. All five. Nicholas turned to the four impaled on stakes behind him. All four were slumped. The fifth man lay slouched in the far corner. All five limp and still. All five dead. Their spirits gone. The room was as silent as a crypt. The bull before him glowed only with the fragment of his own spirit. He drew it back in. He sat in the stillness for a long time, waiting for his head to stop spinning. It had been a shock to be in a creature as it was killed, to have a spirit of a person in him as they died, as five of them died. It had been a surprise. Lord Rawl was a surprising man. Nicholas hadn't thought, back that first time, that he would be able to get all five. He had thought it was luck. A second time was not luck. Lord Rawl was a surprising man. Nicholas could cast his spirit out again if he wanted, seek out new eyes, but his head hurt, and he didn't feel up to it. Besides, it didn't matter. Lord Rawl was coming west. He was coming to the great empire of Bandakar. Nicholas owned Bandakar. The people here revered him. Nicholas smiled. Lord Rawl was coming. He would be surprised at the kind of man he found when he arrived. Lord Rawl probably thought he knew all manner of men. He did not know Nicholas the Slide. Nicholas the Slide, who would be Emperor of Dahara when he gave Jagang the prizes he sought most, the dead body of Lord Rawl and the living body of the Mother Confessor. Jagang would have them both for himself. And in return, Nicholas would have their empire. Chapter 29. Anne heard the distant echo of footsteps coming down the long, empty, dark corridor outside the far door to her forgotten vault under the People's Palace, the seat of power in Dahara. She was no longer sure if it was day or night. She'd lost track of time as she sat in the silent darkness. She saved the lamp for times when they brought food, or the times she wrote to Verna in the journey book, or the times she felt so alone that she needed the company of a small flame, if nothing else. In this place, within this spell of a palace for those born Rawl, her power was so diminished that it was all she could do to light that lamp. She feared to use the little lamp too often and run out of oil. She didn't know if they would give her more. She didn't want to run out and only then find they would give her no more. She didn't want not to have at least the possibility of that small flame, that small gift of light. In the dark, she could do nothing but consider her life and all she had worked so hard to accomplish.